This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Peak Design. They design gear that lets creative, adventurous people follow their passions, and they bring all of their products to life through crowdfunding. Through Friday of this week, Peak Design is running its 7th Kickstarter campaign, and it's one I'm particularly excited about because they're revamping their greatest hits, an all-new capture clip, slide strap, and slide light strap. Hear all about the campaign in the middle of this episode. In the meantime, learn more at www.peakdesign.com/she. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
Caves are really kind of a last frontier of exploration. Obviously, they aren't very accessible. They can be dangerous. They aren't comfortable. With that also comes this kind of mysterious, elusive environment that really kind of stirs people's imaginations and perceptions. And even just the basic sensory experience of walking through the cave, all together, it just kind of boils down to an innate human desire to understand and explore the unknown and satiate that curiosity.
Why did you want to share Oregon Caves National Monument with She Explores listeners?
As a national monument in this smaller Park Service site, I think it's important that we're paying attention to these other resources and making sure that they have our support and that we can protect these places too. So that's part of it, just sort of drawing attention to these other avenues of exploration. Another piece is just that I really enjoyed my time there, and I think I just want to share that with everyone else. I'd never gone caving before going to Oregon Caves, and it was a really fun adventure, totally different environment. And I think like the She Explores community is such an intrepid group and always looking for different ways to kind of stretch into these new experiences.
This episode is reported by Corinne Bishop. For years, Corinne lived and worked in Washington, D.C. Her boyfriend is a national park ranger, and when he was offered a seasonal position at Oregon Caves National Monument, Corinne decided it was time to leave the hustle of the city. She kept her full-time job, transitioning to working remotely, and she also applied to the relatively new artist-in-residency program there. In her spare time, Corinne is a writer and has written pieces for the Sierra Club, Adventure Journal, Misadventures Magazine, even She Explores. Balancing the residency program while working remotely came naturally in the quiet of Oregon.
I actually found that I was getting so burnt out in DC, and I think I was just, you know, I didn't grow up in a huge city, more of like a college town sort of size, and working in that environment made me just really stressed. And so I think that made it harder to enjoy like the pieces of my job that I really care about. I work on federal homelessness programs, and it's near and dear to my heart and something that I want to continue doing. But when I was in that environment, it was hard to connect back to the importance of that issue. And getting into a place like Oregon Caves and being able to have my downtime be in such a peaceful environment and be able to like really explore my creative outlets made balancing that job actually like a lot easier than when I was in the city.
As an artist in residence at Oregon Caves, Corinne has a particular interest in it as a small park.
It's 20 miles up this twisty, steep road from the tiny town of Cave Junction, and it's very off the beaten path. So if you don't know it's there, if you're not planning that trip, you can easily look over it. And I think nationally it's a similar thing, right? There are over 400 different Park Service sites, and that's just a lot to take in. And when there isn't a lot of public support or knowledge of these different Park Service sites, it can be tough to like get the funding and resources you need for them and the attention that they need in order to have our federal leaders really pay more attention to them.
Can you describe the monument a little bit for me in your own words?
It's actually a national monument and preserve. The monument is, I think, about 400 or so acres. It's nestled up in the mountains. A lot of really beautiful trees, old growth Douglas firs. There's this big tree trail. I grew up in the redwoods, so I'm used to big trees, so I was a little skeptical at first. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, big trees. I know big trees. But I got up to the big tree, and it is truly impressive. It's remarkable that you have this dark cave that doesn't have a lot of life in it, and then in the same little area, you have this just enormous, beautiful, old-growth Douglas fir. So there's that, and then, as I mentioned, there's the preserve part of it, too, and that added about 4,000 acres to the park, and that was to protect the watershed of the part of the creek that runs through the cave, and that part is really beautiful, too.
I mailed Corinne a recorder, and she talked to three women with close relationships to Oregon caves. Kat Gans, the interpretive ranger at the start of the episode, Vicki Snitzler, the park superintendent, and Jean Robinson, an artist who sells her work at the gift shop. Corinne and I discussed all these conversations, so you'll hear snippets of our takeaways as well.
It's really easy for people to be like, and I was kind of like this to begin with. I was like, a cave. There's not a whole lot of life in there. Mostly browns and darkness and compared to like doing a hike up in this wildflower meadow where there are like all of these different colors and different sort of sensations. Caves to me seemed like, what's the big deal? And Kat is one of those people who can show you what the big deal is and like really connect you to this resource. So I wanted to share her enthusiasm for the cave. She talks so poetically about how people experience the cave, why this is an important resource, and like what our kind of human connection is to these types of environments.
Let's meet Kat.
So I'm here in the Oregon Cave Chalet with Kat Gans. Thanks so much for taking a break from the cave today to chat with me.
No problem. It's actually nice to be above ground for a little bit.
So to start, would you be able to tell us what your position is here at the park and how long you've been doing this for and just kind of what that work typically entails?
Yeah, of course. So my official job title is Interpretive Park Ranger. Basically, what it boils down to is I'm here to connect our visitors to the resource they're visiting in as many ways as possible. Here, what this mostly means is giving tours of the cave. It also includes doing junior ranger swear-ins, roving the trails in our visitor center, tours of our chateau and historic district, and actually a little bit of community outreach, too. So it's a pretty multifaceted position.
How did you end up at Oregon Caves? What kind of path led you to becoming an interpretive ranger here?
It's kind of a storied one. I specifically remember in high school or middle school going to visit Gettysburg on a vacation, and we went on an interpretive tour there with what I thought was park ranger. And after the whole thing, I started talking to him, and I was like, this is a really cool job. I didn't know that you could get paid to do this. And he said he wasn't getting paid. He was a volunteer, and most of their staff was too. After that, I kind of took up working with environmental education at camps and on a tall ship and a whole bunch of different things. And it never really hit me that a park ranger was like the end all and be all. But I did a 2-week long road trip helping my friend move from New Jersey to California. We stopped at every single national park we could. And it really just kind of hit me that was what I wanted to do. And I started applying. And after a whole bunch of issues with USAjobs.gov, I finally got a few interviews and decided, since I already loved caves a lot, that Oregon Caves was the park that I wanted to accept an offer from. And here I am.
So frankly, something that stood out to me during my time at Oregon Caves is its size. It's obviously a smaller, more intimate park service site when compared to larger, more well-known places like Yosemite or the Grand Canyon. So as a ranger, what makes working in that type of a smaller environment special?
I actually haven't worked at any large parks yet. This is my first and only. But one thing that I love here is the sense of community that we have. I personally know our superintendent. We have after-work gatherings sometimes, and all divisions of the park show up, maintenance, interp, law enforcement, our office staff. I think it really leaves a lot of room for growth and discussion. We all work together to create the best park that we possibly can. And something else that goes along with it, of course, is a tight-knit living situation. Basically, our office space and dorm space is shared, and you get to know people really well. And though there are some issues sometimes, it kind of forces you to communicate with the people that you're working with on a different level. And that's something that I just really love here.
And so we're actually in your home right now.
Yes.
The visitor / offices / dorms. Clearly, more stands out to me about Oregon Caves than just its size. The park is a really unique resource, and caves in general seem to be one of those lesser understood types of environments by the general public. You know, it's easy to think like they're just dark and cold and wet, but I know people travel from around the world to visit this place. So what do you think draws the public to visit this park, and what about cave environments do you particularly find inspiring?
For me, caves are really kind of a last frontier of exploration. Obviously, they aren't very accessible. They can be dangerous. They aren't comfortable. They're cold and wet, just like you said. So with that also comes this kind of mysterious, elusive environment that really kind of stirs people's imaginations and perceptions. I think that's a big draw on its own. When you start layering in all the other really awesome, amazing geologic forces that created the environment, the evolutionary and biologic struggles and fights for survival inside the caves, along with the adaptations that come with it, with the critters that live in there, in addition to just the evidence of our paleo past there. And here in particular, we have a lot of kind of kitschy, kooky folklore going along with the caves from the 1800s. So really, there's something here for everyone. And even just the basic sensory experience of walking through the cave, all together, it just kind of boils down to an innate human desire to understand and explore the unknown and satiate that curiosity.
That's awesome. Do you have a story of a particular visitor who was moved by the cave on one of your tours that you could share?
Yeah, last year I actually, we were getting down to the end of our season. It was getting cold, kind of snowy. Our visitation dropped. I ended up having two people on a tour when we usually average about 15. The both of them were from a city. They said that they weren't really interested in science at all and had never been into a cave before. So since it was just the three of us, I brought us through with flashlights only, and we got to really check out the environment, and I slowly started easing into the science, and they got it right away, and we're just eating it up. And by the end of the tour, they were asking me really complex geologic, ecological questions, some of which I couldn't even answer. And in addition to that, just constantly saying, wow, what? This is crazy. So that's really what I want at the end of the day for all of our visitors to feel. And it was just so cool that I got to have them have that really personal experience and really become a part of the environment that they were visiting.
It's also great that in the later part of the season, you were able to go through the cave in a creative way with just the flashlights and kind of try something new.
Definitely one of my favorite parts of working here.
So personally, I had a blast going on the off-trail cave tour with you and Ranger Dana. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the off-trail tours offered at Oregon Cave?
It's kind of a misnomer. Here we use the term off-trail. We're technically on a trail, but through a wild section of the cave. What most of our visitors go through is what we consider to be the show cave portion. There's lights, there's pathways, there's staircases. It's very accessible. To go into a wild section of cave is really to go into the cave in its natural state. What we do here is kind of a caving 101 class. We bring you through basically every single horizontal caving problem that you'd experience anywhere. With that, we provide the safety information, resource information that you would need to know if you wanted to go caving in the future. In addition to lending out gear, we have certified guides bring you through, and it's really a unique opportunity. Caves, like I said, aren't accessible. It's hard to break through and just go caving and do it in a safe and responsible way. So we provide that opportunity, and really, I think it's the coolest thing that we have going on here. With our larger tour groups, it's mainly me just kind of talking and trying to start a conversation. But with these ones, you really get to know your group. We only allow 8 maximum visitors on it. You need to work together, and that's one of the first things we address in the kind of classroom portion about it. It's also challenging. You have to climb up and down rocks, go through very tight squeezes, crawl on your belly. It's cold in there. It's wet. It's challenging for a lot of people. And I've had a few folks say that it was one of the hardest things they'd done that year. And watching from the beginning of their tour to the end, them build up their own body confidence, it's so cool to just see people be thrown into a situation that they possibly never thought that they would have gotten into ever, like going caving. How do you get into that? It's crazy. So, like I said, it's one of the coolest things, and I love caving, and I'm so happy that I get to share that experience with people who may not have gotten involved in caving earlier in their lives.
Yeah, I know. I had never done anything like that before. There was something really magical to me about the moment when we all lied down on that slab of marble, turned off our headlamps, and listened to the cave's water just trickling about while we were in total darkness. I'd come on the tour solo, and I'll admit that I was a little scared of how I'd feel in the cave, but when we were all lying there, there was a sense of community for me in this underbelly of the Siskiyou Mountains that really calmed any remaining nerves I had.
Yeah, I think that moment that you're talking about, we get into a really tight spot, everyone's shoulder to shoulder with each other, lying on their backs. We turn off the lights, and I believe in that tour in particular, Dana took us through a kind of guided meditation / geologic history of how the caves formed from the end Permian extinction, going to the uplift of the Siskiyou Mountains, how the caves started forming through acidic water dripping through them, following into the history of our exploration and us becoming a national monument, and even us being a part of a history there right then. And it's so cool to be in the cave in its almost completely natural state, in an area that you had to work as a team to get to, and be sitting there really engaging with the environment. You can get a feeling for not only all of the people that you're working with, but you being a part of the history and the environment that we are currently visiting.
It was really neat. It was kind of like being in the womb of the world.
Yeah.
And you're like crawling on your hands and knees and eventually end up back out in this bright, warm world.
Yeah, it was really primordial.
Yeah. It did feel like quite the accomplishment.
I imagine that there's also an after effect to that too. Did that carry with you for like the rest of the day or going into like the next week?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd been a total stress bucket leading up to this cave tour too. I think it was a really nice reset for me to be able to just like escape from everything else. This cave of digital blue light and my forever growing inbox notifications, you know. It was nice to get away from that and like have this sort of reset and almost be reborn into this world where there's this bright sun and all of this warmth and like a really intense sense of gratitude for all of those little bits of everyday life. So I think it did help and kind of last for a little while, just in like recentering me and preparing me for going back and like writing about this experience and also getting back to my day job and all those other kind of activities.
Next, you talked with Vicky, the superintendent of the park. Why did you want to talk with her?
I wanted to talk with Vicky because when I got to the park, I was just really excited that there was a woman leading this park that was the superintendent. I thought that was great. I've seen the headlines about sexual harassment in the Park Service and a lack of diversity. And for there to be a woman leading this park, I knew that that was an opportunity to start changing that dialogue. And I wanted to see what her experience was like in the park. I wanted to give a female face to this position so that She Explores listeners can know that, like, these women are out there and that they can aspire to those kinds of leadership roles as well.
This is Superintendent Vicky Snitzler.
So I've been here at the superintendent for Oregon Caves since June of 08, so I'm almost hitting the decade mark. And so the superintendent of a park is basically the park manager or the unit manager. So you have responsibilities for all of the park operations, all of the partnerships with other agencies. For instance, here at Oregon Caves, that's with the Forest Service, since they are our neighbor on all sides, and other sorts of responsibilities with partnerships, community relations, and all the sort of regulatory requirements that you have when you manage different resources within the park itself.
I think a lot of our listeners are interested in careers with the Park Service and being able to advance into leadership roles. What was your experience with the Park Service or other organizations leading up to this position?
So I have been with the federal government 31 and a half years. Primarily, that has been with the Park Service. I did have a brief vacation, I guess you could call it, with the Environmental Protection Agency, and I worked for them out of the New York City office for 5 years, mostly doing NEPA compliance and doing relationship building with tribal environmental programs. So within the Park Service, I've worked for almost every division. I started out as an interpreter, and I went into resource management, was a division chief, and then became a management assistant for a superintendent in a park in Alaska, Wrangell St. Elias. And then from there, I moved here to Oregon Caves. I've been on the East Coast, in the West, in Alaska, and now on the West Coast.
What would be your advice to other women who are interested in pursuing a career at the Park Service and potentially moving into a superintendent role one day?
I think having a varied background within the Park Service is important so that you get that diversity of what the different divisions do. I think being able to embrace responsibility, being the person who steps up when the leadership in the park needs somebody to facilitate a project or to take on extra duties. I think those are the important things that management is looking for in terms of promoting folks. And I also, I know it's 2017, but I also have to say that you have to get used to being the only girl in the room sometimes. That's just the way it is. So you got to be happy with that.
You were surprised when she said that, right? Taken aback a little bit?
I was. I'd asked her this question, like, kind of expecting maybe a like bureaucratic response to it. So when she threw that out there, even though it wasn't necessarily a surprising reaction, I still just was really surprised hearing it come from this woman in this leadership position, just speaking very frankly. I didn't really know how to respond at the time because I wasn't expecting it. So I was just like, okay, next topic. I actually followed up with her later when the recorder wasn't rolling and I wasn't feeling quite as nervous. She had some really interesting insight. I asked her like how sometimes being the only woman in the room makes her feel. She mentioned that sometimes it feels lonely, and then sometimes there's this added pressure of really not wanting to screw up, because if she does, it might affect other women getting the chance to do what she's doing. And I thought that was really interesting. Already being in this leadership role that takes a lot of work, and then that added stress of feeling responsible for the rest of women as well, and knowing that others are looking to you to kind of lead this path. Making sure other women get to have this opportunity, and that, I don't know, if you do something wrong, it's not going to be taken away from everyone else, because there's some idea that, like, oh, well, this woman couldn't pull this off, so we should probably just leave this to the guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Vicky also has the benefit of 30 years of this, like seeing changes over 30 years and having all of those experiences building into her own perception of her place in the Park Service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm excited, though, to have Vicky in that kind of a position. She mentioned that she was able to hire two women as chief rangers during her time at Oregon Caves, and she was stressing this concept of women have to help other women succeed, and I really appreciate that. I mean, I got connected with She Explores when I wrote that piece about the power of partnership and, like, women working on projects together. And I think that all plays into that of women just being stronger together and being able to build each other up in these different areas that they're passionate about.
Needless to say, I completely agree. Corinne's conversation with Vicky continues after a word from our sponsor, Peak Design. This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Peak Design. They design gear that lets creative, adventurous people follow their passions, and they bring all of their products to life through crowdfunding. Through Friday of this week, Peak Design is running its 7th Kickstarter campaign with updates on all their greatest hits, an all-new capture clip, slide strap, and slide light strap. I can't wait to try the new capture clip. I love to hike with my DSLR, and being able to clip it to my backpacking bag strap has really transformed my hiking experience. I don't know about you, but I find it really frustrating to hike with a camera strap around your neck. After a 3-day hike on the Lost Coast in California, with my DSLR bumping against my stomach with every step, I got myself a capture clip, and I've taken so many photos since. Most recently on the Mahoosuc Trail in Maine and New Hampshire, and in the Sierras of California. This week's Kickstarter features Peak Design's classics revamped. I'm excited to try a smaller, sleeker capture on my next hike. Learn more at www.peakdesign.com/she. That's P-E-A-K design.com/she. Okay, back to the show.
So when I first met you at the Summer Solstice Staff Barbecue, you were wearing a shirt that had an image of Oregon Caves on it, and that read, "Found My Park," which is a fun response to the Park Service's Find Your Park campaign during its centennial last year. So I guess I'm wondering, what is it about Oregon Caves that makes it your park, and how do you know when you found it?
I think part of that answer is where you find inspiration. And I think one of the real surprises for me in coming to Oregon Caves after a big Alaskan park was, and when I came here, the park was only 400 acres. Now it's 4,000. We've had an expansion, but a very small park, from a 13 million acre park to a 400 acre park. So to think that I could find opportunities for solitude in a 400-acre park was very surprising to me, and that's something that I really like here, and I really like as a manager to be able to offer that for our visitors. There's lots of trails within the park that you will hike, and you will not see anybody else. You'll be the only person there. And the other thing I think that's really inspiring about Oregon Caves is it's such a great melding of natural and cultural resources. We have the cave resources, we have the old growth forest resources, but then we have what I think is that enchanting Great Lodge of the Pacific Northwest, the chateau, and all the other historic structures. So just having that blend is, it really makes you feel good to see it working together.
Yeah, it's really a diversity of resources within that 4,000 acres. I've actually been exploring a theme that I've experienced here, that smaller Park Service sites such as Oregon Caves foster a greater or at least a unique sense of community when compared to some of these larger national parks or more well-known national parks. And I guess you've already talked about this a little bit, but what kind of ways
Do you think Oregon Caves fosters a unique sense of community or creativity given its size?
One of the things that helps is it's a smaller park within the systems, and therefore there's a smaller staff. Everyone gets to know everybody within the Park Service staff, within the concessioner staff, within the Natural History Association staff. So you really start to get that coalescence of family. And I remember when I first became a superintendent and the regional director was giving me my marching orders. I mean, one of the number one things is to take care of your staff, take care of your family. And so I think, you know, it starts here at the park, but then it's wider than that. Cave Junction, the city of Cave Junction is 20 miles away, and that's our community. We are their backyard. And somewhat similarly, like the park, they're a pretty small place. You know, the city, I think itself proper is 1,500 people. It's a growing community. They're just doing strategic planning as well. So I think being a part of that, where everyone there wears many hats as well, in small places, everybody kind of has to come together and take responsibility and move the projects and move the priorities forward.
I went to a city hall meeting actually in Cave Junction, and I was really touched by how people really seem to care about the community and finding ways to better it for everyone. That was really nice. You mentioned the historic Chateau Lodge a minute ago, which is a really beautiful structure here. And I noticed that in the gift shop there, many of the items for sale are made by local artists and crafters. And I'm wondering how that partnership to sell local goods began.
Well, I think it happens because of what we were just talking about in a small town where you have to wear many hats. So the current concessioner is a local nonprofit, and so it has its own board to help with their direction. And one of the board members is also a board member on the Illinois River Valley Arts Council. So that kind of cross-pollination between the two boards happened, and that fostered that sense of commitment to the local artists here. I've been really surprised at how well the art consignment does. I wouldn't have initially thought that the traveling public would want to sort of try to figure out how to get a 3x4 oil painting in the car with them or travel with them. And so it's been gratifying to see how well the artists do.
Yeah, and it's such an array of things. Like, I've seen jewelry in there and ceramics and paintings and wool hats.
Yeah, it runs the entire gamut of what material artists are working with.
And you've kind of talked about this already as well, but what value do you think this partnership adds to the experience that visitors are having in the park? And what about connecting the park back to the broader Southern Oregon community?
Well, I think the Park Service has a really long tradition of being able to connect visitors to parks and park resources through history, through science. And I think we're only just catching up to connecting our visitors through the arts. And I think that's a very important connection to offer. The Artist in Residence program, things of that nature that help folks come here and really interact in a real creative way.
There's so much here to be inspired by, and it's wonderful to have these different creative outlets. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me again today. Really appreciate it. I know there's a lot going on at this park, and also thank you for the opportunity that I've had these past several months to be inspired by this park, and I hope that other artists and residents get that chance as well.
Thanks for being here for this season, and yes, the program will continue, and best of luck as you go to your new park at Mount Rushmore. There's great stories there.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Did you feel supported as an artist in residency there?
I did, yeah. I felt like I could ask Vicky questions whenever I wanted to. She would send along some interesting tidbits about the local literary magazine or other events that were going on. I also got to do some reading and editing of different park staff's reflections on the park. George Herring is also the chief of interpretation, and I worked a lot with him as well, thinking through some of the projects we might want to do while I was there. He connected me to like all sorts of people that were really interesting to talk to while I was in the area.
As you can tell, community is a key element of work in caves, which is reflected by the focus on art. Lastly, Corinne talked with Jean Robertson. I asked her what drew her to Jean of all the artists in the chateau.
She has a lot of jewelry for sale in the chateau. It just caught my eye. I don't know, it's just really, really pretty. But then you look closer and you're like, wait, that looks a little different. I noticed like they were all these little bits of technology, which also seemed interesting, like being in this park in this really natural setting. It was odd to see that. I looked into her a little bit more and read her artist statement. It was clear that like this was a very intentional choice for her to be using these materials. She was kind of exploring this unknown side of them, taking these bits of technology and just making something new and something that feels even a little more natural than it may otherwise feel doing the function that it was made for. And she works out of this really wonderful studio that she actually designed as well. It's right in the woods next to this creek. It's just like a very natural, naturally inspiring area to be. And I just was really intrigued by the fact that she was in nature, being inspired by nature, and choosing to use technology as her medium.
I've been here since 1984. We moved here to find a quiet, peaceful place to live, not necessarily where there was work. I call myself a designer because I think it doesn't matter what medium you work in, you know, that I can design anything. So this is my studio that works for everything, whether it's a house or an evening dress or a piece of jewelry. This is where creativity happens, in the wild woods.
Something I've been exploring while living at Oregon Caves is how being at a smaller Park Service site really fosters a sense of creativity and community. And so you're originally from San Francisco, which is quite a different environment than where you are now. What's important to you about doing your work in this type of an environment rather than in a large city, both in terms of the natural surroundings of the location, but also how you've sustainably designed your studio?
Well, I think I can think here to be now when I go back to San Francisco to visit, it's too much stimulation. There's too many people and too much noise and too much man-made things. You know, I like the peace of the wild world here. I think it's either America or city life. It's overstimulating and it's wasteful. You know, there's just too much of everything. And so I like being simple and efficient. And we have our own electricity here. We're off grid. And we did that mostly for intellectual reasons, that the power is right out on the highway, but we wanted to be a little more independent. And it makes you think about what you're using. So I like to be purposeful here in the woods.
I saw the big solar panels up there when I drove in. And I think that's so true. I spent the last 6 years in D.C. There's just so much hustle and bustle that it could be hard to think. And it's also easy to get into that pattern of like using and throwing away even all of the, I think about all of the takeout food and just
the containers.
Right. There's so much waste and unconscious waste. So you mentioned there being too many man-made things in the city, but something that I love about your art is how much of it is created out of old bits of technology and these man-made things. It's such an interesting material to be using while living in such a woodsy environment. So what about these kinds of components inspires you?
We downsized my father-in-law, who is now 97, and he was into electronics. And he had these beautiful old electronics from the 1940s that were capacitors that looked like little dominoes and striped parts and resistors that looked like Tootsie Rolls, all these cool shapes. And he also had a lot of tools, so I could take things apart. I like the machine perfect look of the circuit boards mixed with the really lumpy organic natural pearls that I put on them. You know, I like the mix of machine parts. And when I make creatures, I like to take machine parts that are appealing to me because of their shape and leave them the way they are, not change them too much. So I guess it's the form follows function. If it's a cool, effective shape, just use it the way it is. I take things apart and I look at them and it's like, oh, that's a bug body, or that would make a good antenna for somebody, or somebody's tail, or that's their jaws, or a good pair of feet, you know?
It's yeah.
Like, something about the shapes gets me.
And for our listeners' benefit, we're sitting at a table right now, surrounded by some of Jean's creations, a lot of different bugs and dinosaur-like creature, and some necklaces and different jewelry. The earrings I'm wearing now are actually one of your creations too, and they're made from old circuit board and electronic push buttons, along with garnet and metal beads. And looking closely at them, I noticed some of the coding on the circuit board, different strings of numbers. And two of those codes are next to what I assume are their corresponding commands, one being pause and the other being play. And when I read those, I knew that in their original state, they related back to technology, telling a particular electronic device to when to pause and when to continue. However, reading those digital commands when I found them at Oregon Caves, for me, translated to something that was really far away from computers. I thought about how wilderness reminds me to pause and to play when I may otherwise be wrapped up in the stresses of day-to-day life. So I really appreciate what you've done there. And I'm wondering, what are some of the other kind of unexpected parallels you've maybe found between these materials and nature?
Well, I live in the woods here, and I like trees and leaves and water and the way light moves through the forests. It's interesting that I make bats and bugs and creatures of all kind, dragonflies that are the size of the real ones that fly. I'm always imagining someday, too, I'll make a Victorian little lamb pull toy on wheels, but it'll be made out of machine parts and really be a monster. My brain works in curious ways. But I sort of translate the natural into these fantastic creatures. Sometimes I think the more I live in the woods, the more exotic and fantastic the designs that come out of my head get.
You have all of that room to think.
To go, yes.
You write, "My goal is to open your eyes to the unexpected, to create startling art pieces and wearable art featuring extraordinary design, color, and materials." So having originally found your work in the gift shop of the Oregon Cave Chateau, this mission statement struck me as quite fitting for that park. When I went on my first cave tour, I found myself relying on senses that I don't use in the same way when I'm in a familiar above-ground environment. And I could find myself looking for unexpected bits of beauty within the darkness. A big part of the park staff's role is helping the public open their eyes to the unexpected of the cave. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to visit the cave, and if so, how that experience may have influenced any of your pieces, or if there are any other experiences you've had at the park that have inspired you.
I've been to the caves many times. It's a favorite spot. My mother visited when she was a girl, and many times later in her life, so I love the caves. And I love the big tree hike. There's a giant, giant tree out there I love that. And one thing I think, like you say, going to the caves in the dark makes you really look at the world. You know, to me, I think that's what artists do, is they really look at what they're seeing. That a lot of people look at the world and see what they remember is there. And I look at the world and I see all kinds of different things. Maybe my mind is just not working the way everybody else's is, but that's how I work. And I know when I had my jewelry up at the caves at the beginning, they said, "Well, we sell a lot of bats." Well, of course, it's a caves, and everybody likes bats. They're cool little creatures. So I'm thinking, how do I make bats out of my dead electronics? Good grief. And then I realized that the device that reads a hard drive on your computer is this long, narrow, pointed shape that's very machine-like and perfect, and I save those for bat bodies. And then inside keyboards is this piece of Mylar with all these neat lines on it that I cut bat-shaped wings out of, and I put two little eyeballs on them and make magnets out of them.
Oh, those are great.
Making bats, that was really, they pushed me into that. I would never have thought of making bats myself, but... And then, of course, I had leftovers from the bat wing, so I have to make bugs out of the leftovers from the bats.
Yeah, I love all of the bats up at Oregon Caves, and it's really interesting how those shapes really worked out.
And I think the bats I make for the caves, tourists can go to the caves and come back with some unique thing made here to remind them of their trip to Oregon that does not come from anywhere else.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, too. Thinking about gift shops and going and buying, you know, this mass-produced thing, you just end up with a lot of waste with that and not necessarily things that have a really close meaning to someone. So being able to have these one-of-a-kind treasures from local artists is something really special that I think that visitors can take from their experience here.
I'm used to that in my life. My father and mother made things. My mother was a seamstress and my father was a machinist. And we, all our lives, always made custom things exactly for us. So I think that's normal. Everybody should have the perfect thing just for them.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for letting me come visit you at your studio and talk to you about your art. I really love your work and how you're reusing all of these items to make something unexpected and beautiful. And I'm also really happy that it has a place at Oregon Caves.
Thanks very much.
That total darkness, I reflected on a lot the several times I went through the cave. You can put your hand in front of your face and kind of wave it back and forth, and you cannot see your hand. There's no light. Your eyes can't process that image, but your brain starts to try to make up what it knows is there. You feel like you can see something there, like your hand, but it's really just your mind filling in that space. So Jean and I were kind of talking about being inspired by that total darkness and it being this interesting opportunity to really like see from a new angle. And I think like that's really what she does with her art too, is like taking these motherboards from computers and looking at them differently. Oregon Caves really gives you that opportunity to like explore something unknown and really see something from a different perspective.
These interviews were recorded in Curran's last week at the park, so it's only fitting that we return to her final words with the interpretive ranger.
And before we wrap up, I have one final question. Would you do me the honor of swearing me in as a junior ranger of Oregon Caves National Monument and Preserve?
Of course. So
I've completed my booklet here, so I will pass that over
right
to you.
So checking your work. Let's see. It looks like you have gone above and beyond with this. So the final stage, of course, I'll sign off on this, but I'm first going to have you raise your right hand and repeat after me. As a junior ranger,
as a junior ranger,
I promise
to help protect
and preserve all of the animals,
plants,
and rocks
of Oregon Caves,
and of the world. I also promise
to tell all of my friends
about how cool caves are. Excellent. Congratulations.
All right.
Corinne recently wrapped up her time at Oregon Caves and has since moved to South Dakota near Mount Rushmore. A piece she wrote as an artist in residence about the importance of national preserves was published last week on Gossamer Gear's blog. She has a forthcoming piece on Sierra Club about her experience on the Oregon Caves off-trail tour, the one she talked about on this episode. We'll include all links to her articles in the show notes and on the episode page via she-explorers.com/podcast. Thanks to Corinne for sharing her love of the park and lifting up a place we likely would not have heard of, These small parks are integral pieces of our country's landscape and offer more than meets the eye. Thanks as well to Vicky Snitzler, Kat Gans, and Jean Robertson for their candid interviews. We'll be back in 2 weeks with an interview with Katie Fetters, who has started a movement called Cerebral Palsy Strong. Thanks to our sponsor, Peak Design. You can learn more about their latest Kickstarter at peakdesign.com/she. Music is by Lee Rosevere, Broke for Free, Anon, Sergei Cheremizinov, Mon Plaisir, and Kevin McLeod. Have fun out there.